I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Brian Jones. He's an actor, activist, and teacher. And since 1999, he's been performing the one-man show Marx in Soho. It's a play by Howard Zinn, which was recently at the Lensic here in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me.
So in this play, the historian Howard Zinn, whom we know as, among other things, the author of A People's History of the United States, paints this portrait of Karl Marx that is very human. We meet his wife and his children. We see his drunken arguments with the anarchist Bakunin and their intellectual battles and so on. Is this a reasonably accurate portrait of Marx? I mean, is it drawn from the historical record?
There is a lot in the play that is drawn from the historical record. And if you buy the South End Press edition of the play itself, the text of the play, they have some recommended readings in the back about Marx's life, some of the best biographies of his life and the life of his family. However, it's important to recognize that, yes, Howard took some creative license in bringing Marx back to our time. And some of that creative license has to do with things like the drunken argument with Bakunin. So, you know, we don't know of a physical brawl with Bakunin, but that was meant to, I think, highlight the very real political debates between them.
What's so interesting, and one of the things that's interesting is that when people represent, when you have historical figures like Marx, Engels, who represent an ideology that is not in favor by whoever's in power, they try to find psychological reasons why the person thought that way. I thought that was such an important point that the play brought out, and that it was beautifully refuted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. I think what's interesting about what's happening right now, living through this very intense economic contraction in the age of austerity, is that a number of mainstream commentators, as they often do, have rediscovered Marx, at least in the negative. I mean, so they will concede quite a bit about Marx. They will concede that he was right about crisis. They will concede that he was right about the excesses and problems and contradictions of the system. What they won't concede is the part of the play about the Paris Commune, is the part of the play that offers some idea that ordinary people could run things a different way, that some other kind of way of living is possible. They will not concede that. So I think that, yes, there will always be an attempt to discredit Marx. What's interesting to me is that they keep bringing him up. I mean, they can't let it go.
Well, it's sort of methinks the lady doth protest
exactly.
Too much.
Exactly.
And I was wondering, I mean, I guess it's, you just said it, why that is, namely that such a huge part of his analysis, no matter what you do, is still correct.
Yes. And I think the feeling that class matters, that your relationship to work, are you the person who shows up and sells your time for money, or are you the person who owns the place, that those relationships are coming to the fore once again in our politics and political discussion. What else is the real meaning of the whole 99% versus 1% slogan that is now so ubiquitous? If not a sentiment that there's a tiny group of people who, by dint of their wealth, seem to dominate every aspect of our lives, and in a way that seems rigged in their own favor, such that even those who do everything they're supposed to do, put their heads down, play by the rules, et cetera, can be completely screwed. And so there's a feeling that there's something wrong with that whole setup of wealth and the disparity. And that's what seems to be coming to the front now, or to the front of people's brains.
And what's, I think one of the ironies in that we have seen over and over, I mean, we saw it in the Great Depression and FDR, and we're seeing it again, is that if that super wealthy class would share just enough, people would have their basic need met, and there would still be inequality, but it would be livable. And for whatever reason, and maybe you can help us understand this reason, they always push it to the point where life becomes intolerable for the people on the bottom.
Intolerable. I mean, they're cutting food assistance to the poorest families and children. They're cutting health care for the neediest people, and including children. They're just the way that they are, in the most draconian fashion, cutting everything to the bone. It's exactly as you say. I think one of the dynamics we're living in now that compels them to do this, not out of some deficiency in their souls, although their souls may be deficient, who knows? I don't know, you know, these people personally. But it seems to me there's something about the system of international competition that compels them, that is external to them. It's bigger than the biggest of them. It's bigger than Bill Gates.
Yep.
And it compels them to drive us to the wall. I'm thinking now of the fact that, you know, they're openly in discussion about how it is that China has become a manufacturing center of the world, and why not, and why the United States has lost that position, and how they can get it back. And in their minds, the problem is that we're all way overpaid. So they want to reduce us down to the level of the Chinese Foxconn workers who are, you know, jumping into suicide nets, working insane hours for ridiculous pay, making iPhones and iPads. And, like, that's their vision of what it means to compete. And given the tremendous wealth and resources of the world, the fact that we're at a moment now where we are more productive than we've ever been, we have more incredible technology than we've ever had, it's that contradictory nature of capitalism that Marx captured. On the one hand, producing all of this, unleashing this amazing productivity, and on the other hand, that productivity not leading to a better quality of life. So you have iPhones, this amazing device, and workers committing suicide who make them. And it's
I was going to say, for those who don't know what suicide nets are, these people's lives are so horrible that they are jumping off of buildings, and they have put up nets around these workers' buildings so that they don't actually die, so that they can go back to work.
Yeah, it's amazing.
And these are the people who are making these devices. I'm recording this show right now on a Macintosh computer.
Right, right.
And those contradictions were true in the 1850s, in the 1920s.
Right.
They're true today, and they're fundamental. What would you call it? It's in the DNA of this system that we have, which we are very loath to give up, because although it exploits so many people, it also provides so many people with things that make our lives more comfortable and interesting.
Well, yes. I mean, it raises a question, though, which is, well, where do all these things come from? Where do jobs come from? Do they come from you know, the job creators, as the Republican right likes to call them, or do they come from labor? And so there's a very radical idea that we get from Marx, which is that because the capitalists, even going all the way back to Marx's day, put out this idea that, you know, this is fair. It's all fair in the labor market. The boss comes with his money to start up a business. The worker comes with their labor power, and they make a fair exchange for wages, what have you, and everybody's contributing their part, and everybody walks away with some part of the money. Marx tore that whole thing apart and said, actually, there's something that's fundamental to this process, which is labor itself. Because he asked the question, where does the capitalist get that capital from? Where does that capital come from in the first place? Where does money come from in the first place? And his argument was that all value ultimately comes from labor, and that it's humans' ability to labor intelligently and creatively and socially that is the ultimate source of all value. And if you look at it that way, this is the labor theory of value, then actually we could have all of these wonderful, great things. We could have Macintosh computers and iPhones and maybe even better and more wonderful technology, but we could have them without the conditions that we are currently living under if we got rid of competition for profit and worked ourselves to make these wonderful things.
And again, I mean, we could talk about this for the next 17 hours. But, you know, the whole American ideology is that competition plays a very dynamic and productive role. Mm-hmm. And Lord knows that, I mean, as much as we are cooperative with each other, and I think the kind of theories of anthropology in the time that we're living in are moving toward focusing more on cooperation and things like that. We are a competitive species, and that part of our being is brought out in the system.
Sure, but does it have to be competition to the death? I mean, certainly you can look at plenty of indigenous societies, and like you're saying, there's anthropological studies that show that they had plenty of competitions, foot races and all kinds of things, but that didn't mean they murdered the person who lost the race. So what we have is this kind of insane competition. It's like economic competition. Coke versus Pepsi. And if Coke wins, Pepsi lays off all their workers and thousands of people are thrown into the streets. So we don't need that kind of competition. We, you know, yes, a certain amount of competition is healthy. But on the other hand, is it healthy that, you know, the other day I had a friend staying over. It's like, oh, I forgot my cell phone charger. And it's like, can I use yours? No, because yours is made by a different company. Do we really need to produce 15 different cell phone chargers? Do we really need to produce, you know, 13,000 different kinds of skin lotion? Is the competition between makers of breakfast cereal actually producing healthier breakfast cereal for us? Or is the drive for profit forcing them, compelling them to use cheaper and cheaper and more processed materials and actually producing less and less healthy food? So is that anarchical drive for profit actually making our lives better? I'm not completely convinced that that kind of economic competition is healthy.
Well, and I had an economist on the air last year who pointed out something which I thought was very important in this whole discussion, which is if a company makes $100 million profit every year for 10 years in a row, it's considered a failure.
Right.
Because it didn't grow. And I think about growth and the way that the ideology of growth and the necessity of growth, and as you put it earlier, we're living in a world where these drivers are bigger than the biggest of the big.
Yes.
It's bigger than all of us. That driver for growth, I find myself wondering, and I was wondering as I was watching the play, were Marx to come back not only as Brian Jones on the stage of The Lensing, but that economic mind looking at things the way that he did and the way many people after him have done, would think about the growth and the environment and the way that industrial, not only capitalism, but as we saw in the Soviet Union, industrial communism have tremendously hurt the environment.
Absolutely. I hope that there's another gentleman coming to the Lensic by the name of Chris Williams in a few weeks. March 20th he's coming. Oh, at the James Little Theater. Fantastic. Chris Williams, March 20th. I really hope that you have him on your show, because he has really explored this question a great deal, and he's revealed some interesting things. He and others, I should say. I mean, I don't want to attribute it all to him, but these kind of more radical writers talking about the environment and Marxism, and what they've revealed is that Marx and Engels were actually very sensitive to these questions. What they revealed is that Marx and Engels were very sensitive to these questions of the environment. They saw that there was in their words, a kind of metabolic rupture between the relationship between humans and the environment with the Industrial Revolution. And they certainly thought that it was not about retreating to a more simple society, but that there would be a way to husband the technological improvements unleashed by capitalism in a way that was sensitive to the needs of the environment and, frankly, to the needs of human beings and to the laboring population. And, in fact, we actually see the more you go back and dig into it from that perspective, you start to see the connection between labor and the environment. For example, the way that mine workers in this country were some of the first people to fight for environmental protections, such as clean air laws and this kind of thing, because it was, you know, they were living in these mining towns and they were all dying and their children were all dying and they're, you know, they didn't want their children to die. And so there actually is another tradition of this that's not about growth for growth's sake, but is about trying to figure out how we can use the incredible technology that we have, but in a way that's intelligent and respectful of the need to preserve the ecology of this world. And he also can say much more and more intelligently than I can about this question of the Soviet Union, because there is there's two histories of the Soviet Union. There's the revolutionary history after 1917, and then there's the kind of Stalinized dictatorial history, where, again, you see that kind of growth for growth's sake, where their view is we're going to compete with the West, we're going to build up military, blah, blah, blah. And like you say, it's a developmentist. But let's not equate that with the revolutionary socialist Marxist project of emancipating labor and trying to figure out how to live in harmony with the environment.
We're talking to actor and activist Brian Jones. As you say, in as the Marx character says in the play, even in Marx's time, there were Marxists whom he couldn't stand. He was all like, what are you talking about, you moron, reading my... And these people would get together and earnestly read line by line, which I remember doing things like that myself in college, going through texts and reading. And so the difference between the thinker and the people who immediately took up his work, as you're suggesting, is already a big gap.
Yeah, it's there are many Marxisms. You know, I think there's some things that are kind of fundamental to Marx's ideas that can serve as a guidepost for students of Marx. One is, as I said, the labor theory of value, the idea that labor is the ultimate source of all value and wealth in our society. Certainly, I think what Engels said at Marx's gravesite is true, that Marx was above all else a revolutionist, that he was not kind of abstract thinker, but that he was somebody who was consciously trying to solve these problems and figure these things out so as to participate in a project of changing the world. And I think another fundamental thing we have to say is that Marx was one of the first people to break from the kind of utopian notions of socialism that had come before. That is, and that still persist. The ideas that socialism is going to be given to you by some great benefactor, by some heroic leader, by some politician, by even some guerrilla leader acting on your behalf, some hero who's going to heroically do something heroic, and thereby, you know, you'll open your window shade one day, look out, and see socialism. Rather, Marx and Engels were, for example, the first socialists to support unions, because their view was this is not about dreaming up a utopia and then imposing it on the world. This is about understanding the struggle that's already underway on Earth as it is now, the world as we find it, and understanding that there's a dynamic to the world as we find it that potentially leads to this outcome. So they saw the whole project as self-emancipation, not as something imposed from without. And I think that's an important concept that, unfortunately, a kind of guiding spirit, if you will, that unfortunately the socialist movement at various moments has lost its way and has fallen back into the habit of looking to the great leader, the great hero, you know, be it Stalin or, you know, in my view, Castro or whomever, who's like going to give you great things, rather than a project of self-emancipation from below.
Well, and self-emancipation from below on some level requires that everybody below is on board, which isn't necessarily the case. And it sort of requires what you might call mafia-free space and things like that. And the fact that, I mean, I studied Marx in college and in graduate school a little bit, along with everything else in political science and so on. And the thing that is always the question is really big questions about human nature and human nature within groups and within the size of groups and the conditions of groups and so on. And we've all seen, you know, power struggles over things as weighty as who's going to put up the pastry display at the Unitarian Church, you know?
No doubt.
And so how to deal with issues of power, it ends up being a question that nobody is able to really answer or to make a system that works in which everybody's happy. It hasn't been done yet.
Well, that's why I think the Paris Commune is an interesting part of the play, and in some ways the most radical part of the play. Because if it were true that we as humans were just fundamentally flawed and could not band together and figure out how to organize ourselves in a way that was democratic. Now look, I'm not going to say perfect. I'm not going to say a society in which everyone smiled at every moment, never cried, never got sick, never argued, never fussed, never punched. You know, I'm not going to say that. But could we live in a society where everyone was fed, where everyone was housed, where everyone's basic needs were met, where the debate about should we build 12 schools or should we build 13, you know, where we win regardless of how the vote goes, as opposed to closing school, you know, all the things they're doing today. Could we live in that kind of society? Yes, I think we could. And what's interesting about the Paris Commune is that, you know, they crushed it. And they marched in and they murdered 30,000 people to crush it. Well, why did they have to do that? If we're fundamentally flawed, it seems like they could have just left it alone. Oh, well, workers are in charge now. That'll collapse. That'll come to no good. They could have left it alone and waited for it to collapse. But no, they saw it as a threat. And they've always been afraid when we assert our collective power, our collective desire to put our demands, our interests at the front, and to make decisions ourselves. They're very afraid of that. And I think we've seen other glimpses of the potential for us to organize ourselves in a democratic way. I think the Russian Revolution in 1917 is another glimpse, but certainly there are many others. Again, just glimpses. But what I'm talking about is a society that would be fundamentally democratic in an economic sense. You know, of course, with all kinds of flaws. But I do think that we could achieve.
We're talking to Brian Jones. So let's talk about Howard Zinn and your relationship with Howard Zinn and how this whole play came about and you're performing it all these years.
I know. It's wild. And people always ask me, you know, do you get tired of doing this play? And it's like, no, I really don't. It's crazy. I've been doing it since 1999. But every time I'm about to go on stage, it feels like I'm jumping out of an airplane, you know, because there's no intermission.
Really?
It's like, here we go. I know when I'm about to step on stage, I know that I'm going to be talking for the next 75 minutes with no breaks, with no cue cards, with nobody to, no other characters, nobody to save me. You know, it's just me. And so it's thrilling. The other thing is that as politics changes and as different issues occur and different things come up, there's a way in which there's so many politics and so many ideas in the play that the play always seems fresh because it always seems to be speaking to our particular predicament, even though the lines of the play don't change. And so that I find very interesting, the way audiences react to different things they find funny, different things I find funny or poignant or what have you. So, it's a great thrill. I got started doing this play, as Anthony Arnov said when he introduced it at the Lensic, here at Lensic Theater here in Santa Fe, that it was basically his idea, and he thought that rather than get a kind of older, you know, white-haired guy, as you would imagine Marx, to tap me, his friend, we were both living in Boston at the time, I was 25, you know, I'm African-American, and I did not even have a beard at all at the time. I didn't even know if I could grow one.
So you've had to grow and keep a
beard
all these years?
Yes.
I was wondering about that when I was watching you. Did he want a beard?
It's not the style of our time, you know. And yet here I am. And I do it now just enough times in the year that, you know, there's no sense in ever shaving it off. So one of the first things I had to do was call Howard and, you know, introduce myself to him and arrange a time that we could rehearse together, and then I could show him my kind of version of it and kind of get his okay to go forward. I mean, we needed his green light. And so I called him. I was very nervous, you know. I mean, this is Howard Zinn. I'm calling him on the phone cold, you know. So, you know, I finally worked up the courage to do it. And I called Howard, and I said, you know, we got through the pleasantries, and I said, look, I have to tell you something right away. I'm 25 years old, and I'm black. And Howard paused, and he said, well, you know, they did call him the Moor. And so thus began our relationship. It's true. They did call, Marx's family called him Moor because he was relatively swarthy, as European Jews go. And he, so then we rehearsed in Boston. And I would have to say, looking back at that first performance in that little classroom where we first rehearsed it, I first showed it to Howard. It was horrible. It was horrible. I think I was extremely nervous. And Howard was very patient and gentle and very keen, most of all. I mean, I'm glad he gave me the green light, obviously, and it's really transformed throughout the years and through working with Howard. But one of the things that Howard pointed out to me that I did not realize was just how packed the play is with humor. I didn't even see perhaps half of the jokes that are in the play. And Howard started helping me to bring them out. And so now you see it's a very funny play. I mean, and I play it that way. But that was one of the things that Howard was very keen in from the very beginning, was that the humor come across, because that for him was always, you know, if you ever heard him speak, that was always one of his great tools to kind of popularize radical ideas, was to use humor to do it. So we started touring it around, and many of the shows, those initial shows, Howard would come with, and he would kind of introduce the play and talk about the play. Maybe we would do question and answer afterward. And so it was just an amazing experience. I mean, a totally life-changing experience that I got to work with Howard Zinn, to do this play, to do Marx, to talk about these Marxist ideas, and then sit on stage with Howard Zinn and talk about it together, work together. I mean, it was absolutely amazing. Absolutely an amazing experience. I was just crushed when Howard died in 2010. And my family and I were on vacation for spring break in Burlington, Vermont, and we were on our way to Howard's funeral. And my daughter was born prematurely in Burlington. And so since we had to miss the funeral, you know, we just kind of felt it was just such a moment. And we gave her middle name, Zinn. So my daughter's name is Nina Zinn Jones,
nice.
Named after Howard.
We're talking to Brian Jones, actor, activist, teacher, and performer in the one-man show Marx in Soho. Why did Howard Zinn write a play in the first place? I mean, we know him as a historian. I didn't even know until you came to Santa Fe that he was also a playwright.
Well, my understanding from talking to Howard and hearing him speak about this in those early days was that it was really after the fall of the Soviet Union, there was just a tremendous triumphalism in the Western press. It was like capitalism is the pinnacle of human achievement. We won, communism is dead, all of this kind of stuff. And crucially, this seemed to be a kind of gravestone over Marx's ideas, like these ideas are dead, they're useless. And Howard, someone who was not a member, to my knowledge, of any Marxist or socialist organization, but somebody who always had an affinity for Marxism, and as an academic had taught Marxism, and as a young dock worker in the Brooklyn shipyards, was always schooled in Marxism with a meeting with his coworkers to discuss Marx's ideas and read Capital and this sort of thing. He was greatly offended by all of this and thought that there had to be, maybe there's some creative way to have a response. And so he endeavored to humanize Marx. That's part of what I think you were picking up on, all the stuff about his personal life. And, you know, he once joked that this was like the People magazine, version of Karl Marx. And so he endeavored to humanize Marx. But along the way, his wife, Roz, thought that this one-man show about Marx in the 19th century, it was just a little bit too, it wasn't relevant enough. And so she said, look, what you really ought to do is figure out a way to bring Marx to our time. What would be more interesting is a play that answered the question, what would Marx say if he could see our world, not just discuss his world? And so that, she was the one who really had the idea that Marx should come to our time. And so then he used a little creative license. Since Marx used to live in Soho, London, he thought that the powers above maybe made a bureaucratic error. And instead of returning Marx to Soho, London, they accidentally sent him to Soho, New York. And so Marx is here with us in the United States in our time, no fourth wall, speaking to us.
You are now involved in the Occupy movement, is that correct?
Yes.
What are you doing and where are you doing it?
Well, there's a spin-off there's many different groups that have formed out of the kind of original Occupy Wall Street movement. One of them, an independent group, is called Occupy the DOE, Occupy the Department of Education. And in New York City, it's a group that's trying to use the energy and in some ways the tactics and techniques of the Occupy movement more generally and apply them specifically to the struggles that we're having over education in New York City. And one of the things we're doing is that we're running up against the fact that we have mayoral control of the schools. We have a completely undemocratic system of education wherein one man makes all the decisions. Formally speaking, there's a board that makes the decisions, but it is stacked with a majority of mayoral appointees. And in the history of the board, since mayoral control, the only time any of those appointees have voted against the mayor, that person was summarily removed. So we have a situation in which, for example, they can make a decision. The mayor can make a decision that a school is going to be closed. This school is failing, so he says. And because, you know, they're not making progress on their test scores, this sort of thing. He's going to close down the school. Now, maybe the entire community is in opposition to this. Maybe the parents and students and teachers and everyone is on opposition to this and says, look, if you see deficiencies in our school, help the school. You know, give us resources. Come in and intervene. Don't close us down. And maybe they protest. Maybe they go to the board's hearing, public hearing, and maybe they testify until 4 in the morning. And maybe there's not a single person who gets up to the microphone and says, close the school, and every single soul says, open the school. It doesn't matter. The board still says, close it. So we've seen that happen again and again and again. Occupy comes along, and we start thinking, what can we do? What can we do to raise our protest to another level? And so we started mic checking the chancellor at these hearings, that is literally disrupting the hearings and almost like holding our own meeting on the spot using the people's mic to talk about why we need to keep our schools open. And in the latest instance, we did this with about 2,000 people when they were going to close a great number of schools just the other week. Now,
that must have been hilarious.
It was wild. It's part of the reason my voice is so raspy is that it was a huge auditorium, and, you know, they were ready for us. They cranked up the microphones. All the board members were wearing headphones with mics so they could hear each other. I mean, it was a zoo. And the only good thing that's come, I mean, we didn't win. We did not shut down the meeting. They carried on with the meeting, and they closed the schools, or at least they voted to close them. The good thing that's happened is that movement itself, which, even though we might lose a particular battle, our forces are building. And so it raises the prospect that we will do something else the next time. It brings that potential to the front. And certainly all the media coverage was about the battle and about the protest and about this whole struggle. So it's increasingly becoming an actual debate in New York City. Instead of just the mayor says this and the press repeats it, it's like now they have to quote us because it's clear that there's more than one side to this story. Another thing, when I was just in Chicago, there was parents and teachers of a school that was slated to be closed, occupied the school, literally sat in their school demanding a hearing with the board members, and they got that hearing, a kind of private meeting between the parents and the board to talk about this whole thing of closing the school. So that was a little victory for them. But the idea of occupying, the idea that we need to take back and reclaim these institutions that are supposed to be ours, that are supposed to be serving the public, is a very radical idea. And frankly, an idea who's come. We see all over New York City right now people occupying foreclosed homes. You know, you're saying, you drove up the mortgage rates and now you're trying to kick me out of this house. Well, maybe me and hundreds of my neighbors are going to keep me in this house, you know, by force of occupation and protest. And so the idea of occupying the schools, literally, occupying our homes, and maybe later, occupying our workplaces. I mean, these are ideas that certainly have a precedent in American history. If we think back to the sit-down strikes or even the civil rights sit-ins, these are ideas that have precedence, as I said, but what's happening now is they're coming back. And yes, in New York City, there's a major battle over education, and we're in a process of trying to figure out how to take our struggle to the next level.
It's interesting also that the media, as you said a moment ago, they tend to just write down what the mayor said or what the school board said, and somehow it's inadequate coverage, and there are not only two sides but multiple sides to all of these stories. And one of the things that about Karl Marx that I didn't know, that I learned watching your play, was that he was a newspaper editor in Germany, and was not only shut down, but he had to flee Germany and went to Paris and then to England.
Yes.
What was he shut down? What did he say?
He was a radical Democrat, little d Democrat. That is, at a time when Germany was ruled by, was still ruled by monarchs, there was, but in the middle of the 19th century, as we know, there was great tumult in Europe, and democratic regimes were sweeping the continent. And Marx was caught up in those, in that energy, in those ideas, and he said, look, we need democracy in Germany. We, you know, people need the right to vote, we should have a parliament. You know, he's talking about basic ideas, but then he also takes up issues of poverty, the plight of the poor. The play specifically talks about how he was editorializing against the new property laws. For generations, people had always been able to do things like gather firewood from the estates of the rich. I mean, just pick up sticks that had fallen on the ground and use them to heat their homes. And then, you know, increasing property, the spread of new property relations made that impossible, because then that meant you were stealing from these estates. Marx was a big idealist in the philosophical sense, in that he thought these superior ideas of kind of what we might call bourgeois democracy, the ideas of personal and political freedom, these ideas are superior, therefore they are going to win out. They're bound to win out, and I'm going to write about them, I'm going to, you know, speak about them, I'm going to be this democratic journalist fighting for democracy in Germany. And then what he found was that when he would write things like about this firewood incident, the people who were funding his paper would say, Oh, no. You're talking about the rich? No. And they would literally withdraw their support from the paper. And then he had this epiphany. It's actually what kind of, it's one of the episodes that led him to become a Marxist. He had this epiphany that...
to become a Marxist.
No, really. I mean, he had an epiphany in this whole episode over the newspaper writing and being a publisher of a newspaper, that there was something about material interests that could actually trump ideas. That even though he was putting out what he thought were these superior ideas, the material interests of different classes of people could trump that. And so that was, he was like, whoa. I mean, he, you know, he studied philosophy. He was kind of like, I don't want to say he was in the clouds, but he was kind of somebody who was operating on the idea that, you know, ideas, the best ideas will win out. And then he realized that, whoa, it ain't necessarily so. Later on, when he encountered actual workers' movements, he realized that there was something about the, you know, the weavers of Silesia, for example, that he encountered, the Chartists in London that he encountered. And these are like rough blue-collar guys who are meeting together and fighting for things like democracy and the vote. And then he realizes, wait a minute, these people, even though they're uneducated or what have you, or, you know, they seem rough around the edges, these people, because of their material interests, actually, even though their ideas may not be all worked out, their material interest is driving them toward in a better direction. They have an interest in fighting for all the right things, for more democracy, for greater personal freedom and liberty. And it's the wealthy people who have an interest in opposing all of that. And so then he kind of figured out, like, oh, that's why there ain't going to be no German Revolution on the model of the French Revolution, because the rich already by that point were afraid of the growing working class. They were so afraid that they were not going to unleash what had been unleashed in France. And so he started to realize that it wasn't just about having philosophical ideas, but it was about understanding the material interests of different groups of people and how that drove them in different directions.
One thing that I loved in your play, Marx in Soho, Howard Zinn's play, but your play too, since you were the, are you the only person who does it?
Not anymore. No, there are other people who've taken it up. And so, yeah, there's a bunch of Marxes. Somebody was joking, we should have like a convention of, you know, everybody get in your get up and like do lines from the play. It'd be hilarious.
With your beard and your...
Yeah, like an Elvis convention or something.
That's hilarious. But one thing that I really liked was the idea that Marx had about what communism was, which is, I mean, when you think about communism, you think about the Soviet Union, Cuba, Romania, whatever. What was it?
Well, in his view, when they, you know, Marx and Engels actually is very interesting because they did not really lay out a whole elaborate view of society. Like, here's what it's all going to look like. And they actually did that for a very particular reason. Because in their view, this was a self-emancipation project. This was a society that was going to be made by the workers. They were more interested in who makes the decision than what the decision will actually be. In their view, we should have a society where workers decide. And then they said, look, of course, there's basic things that workers, whenever they get in power, are likely to decide. Like, everyone should be fed. People should work a decent number of hours, but not insane numbers of hours. You know, things like this. Everyone's health should be provided for. Education should be provided for. These sort of things. He said the workers, you know, the workers, because we work collectively, we have an interest in having a kind of collective society where things benefit us in kind, and that flows not from our human nature, but from our class nature. And the only time where they started to get more into the details of it was when workers somewhere actually did it. And they, rather than imposing a kind of view, again, they more followed what was actually happening. So when the Paris Commune broke out, first of all, they were, you know, tremendous enthusiastic supporters of the commune. But then they were some of the principal people who wrote about it, who described it, who kind of told the story for the world so that people could learn about it and understand the features of it. But yes, it was an incredible revolution wherein, and one of their kind of first visions of what a society might look like, wherein they did things like set up education for women, you know, tried to provide for people's welfare in common. So the people who were elected as, they had a kind of representative democracy, but, you know, people elected to run things. But those electors had no perks or privileges whatsoever. Their pay was exactly the pay of a kind of average, it was pegged at like average worker pay. And, you know, they just did all kinds of things like that to make it a more egalitarian and truly democratic society. There's if you read their writings on the Paris Commune, it's quite breathtaking. You know, in their words, they stormed heaven. That was what they said of the communards. And we know it only lasted 2 months, but that's because it was crushed. You know, they invaded.
Yeah, and those are the experiments that one would so like to see how they do over years, because as we know, being revolutionary and being an administrator of a stable long-term regime are two way different skill sets.
Sure. I think also going back to your previous point about human nature, I think Marx and Engels, there's this line from, I believe it's from the German Ideology, where they say, you know, of course we're not talking about people as they are today. We're not talking about, we understand that people, I'm just paraphrasing them, the people are scarred, if you will, or shaped by the society in which we're living right now, that is capitalist society, where many people don't feel like they can even trust their coworkers, let alone overthrow, occupy, you know, organize with their coworkers. And so their argument was there has to be some kind of mass transformation of people. People have to change. And they have to develop some kind of new consciousness, and which raises the question, well, then how are they going to do that? You know, is it just from seeing Marx in Soho or, you know, something like this? And their argument was no, that it was the struggle itself, and especially as the struggle rises and gets to a kind of revolutionary pitch, that level of organizing, struggling, fighting is the very process that makes possible a new society, which is further goes to the kind of self-emancipation idea. It's like nobody can come in and give this to you because then you don't have that transformative experience of revolutionizing. And so they argued that it's the revolution is necessary, therefore, not only because the class that has to be overthrown can't be gotten rid of any other way. They won't give it up any other way, but also because people have to change. They have to transform themselves. And it's only in that process that they can learn how to rule, learn how to organize with their workmates, learn how to overcome sexism, homophobia, racism, all of the things that divide us and pit us against each other, nativism, you know, learn how to do things that we've been taught we can't do, like get along with each other, like take a vote and make decisions and argue and still be friends after an argument, you know, all the practices that you would need to win any struggle. You're going to need to win a revolution. And I see that right now happening in the struggle around education, any of the small struggles you see happening today. All of these things that we need to learn, we are learning. And if we don't learn them, we're losing, you know. And the more we learn them, the more we're able to go forward. So in my view, and I think in Marx's view, a revolutionary process is where all of these little lessons that we're learning right now in the small would be learned by millions of people through their practical activity, and would prepare us to run society in the same way that we ran the strike and went around and talked to everybody and made sure everybody was on board and had all of the discussions and organized the food and did everything we would need to prepare ourselves to be totally united to shut this thing down. All of that same communication and vote taking and decision making and disagreement and working it out, all of those same skills would be necessary to turn it all back on again. The same skills would be used to run society that we had just used to try to strike, to try to close things down.
And as the character that you play, the Marx character in Howard Zinn's play, Marx in Soho, says that ultimately it's all about people having the opportunity to fulfill themselves.
Absolutely. I mean, I see this as a teacher. When you work with young people, you just realize the immense potential. I mean, you just take any class I've ever taught and you just look at those young humans.
What grades do you teach?
Well, this year I'm teaching fourth grade. Last year I taught second grade. I mean, the things that kids can do and think, and you just see them like brimming with potential. It's just amazing. I mean, you know, and you're constantly in awe of it and constantly annoyed by it, frankly, because it's like, you know, your job is to contain it in these tiny boxes and they're like constantly overflowing it, you know. So it's frustrating. But no, they're just so brilliant. And it makes you think that it's a shame that our society, what our society wants from them is so little of their real intellectual and creative powers. You know, it's like we have this teeny tiny band of our powers and abilities that are able to be expressed in this world. And most of them are not expressed. And I just think about all the people who could be the most brilliant scientists who spend their entire lives picking fruit in the fields of California, you know, who could be the most amazing musicians who spend their entire lives just doing the one job for very long hours, you know, cleaning the office building, driving the cars, you know, all of the jobs that need to get done. And I think there's got to be a way to have a society, and wouldn't we all benefit from unleashing those creative and intellectual powers of the vast majority of society? Wouldn't there be a way? Isn't there a way we can share some of the, you know, cleaning up and driving the buses and that those kinds of things, so that nobody has to just be the one thing. Nobody has to just be the janitor. Like, I'll be the janitor once every 3 months, so that nobody has to be the janitor for, you know, because everybody has more power than that, more potential than that. So I just think our society has produced amazing things, but that's with only a tiny number of people who get to participate in science, tiny number of people who get to participate in the arts. What if we multiplied that millions of times over? What would that do to the arts? What would that do to the sciences?
Yeah, and you see glimpses of that, for example, in the proliferation of digital cameras. I talked once to somebody who was a picture editor at a major magazine, and she said, because now everybody can afford a camera, the pictures that are coming from ordinary people who don't now need to buy darkroom equipment and enlargers and paper and all that stuff is just phenomenal.
Yeah. There's enormous potential. But we see it constrained. I mean, it's greatly, greatly constrained. And there's all these battles over the internet, you know, where it's like they want to put tolls on the internet. They want to be able to determine which sites stream at which speeds. And it's like there's a constant tension in our society between the potential to unleash our social powers and their need to contain all of that in the realm of private profit. And that is the contradiction of our age.
Brian Jones is an actor, activist, and teacher, and he's been performing the one-man show Marx in Soho, a play by Howard Zinn, since 1999. It's just great to have you here in Santa Fe. Thanks for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me. It was fun.